This is Ozarks at Large for Monday, February 27th, 2012. Happy International Polar Bear Day. I'm Antoinette Grajeda. Support for KUAF comes from Rogers Historical Museum, featuring the image of the South in cartoons and comic strips with Comic Stripped, a revealing look at Southern stereotypes in cartoons. It's open through March 24th at the Rogers Historical Museum. More information is available at 621-1154 or rogersarkansas.com/museum. Ahead on this edition of Ozarks, a look back at the largest student strike in the history of the University of Arkansas, remembering the X-ray incident 100 years later. Plus, we have a conversation with Al Bell, the former chairman of Stax Records and former president of Motown Records. We begin this edition of Ozarks with the end of an era at Fayetteville High School. As part of the school's renovation, the current gymnasium, which was built in the early 1950s, will be demolished next month during spring break. FHS played its last basketball games in the old gym Friday night when they took on their cross-county rival Springdale. For one last time, the gym was filled with a large crowd cheering on the young athletes. Here now are some sounds from last Friday's games, as well as Athletic Director Barry Gebhardt sharing his memories of the old gymnasium.
I was the head basketball coach here for 18 years and assistant basketball coach 6 or 7 years before that. And went to high school here, graduated from the University of Arkansas. I grew up about two blocks from here, so this place has been involved, has been in my life pretty much every year since about 1970 or 71. My first memory was as a first grader. You know, times were different back then, but growing up couple blocks from here, I was just out in the neighborhood wandering around and saw a bunch of cars out here and wandered in, and lo and behold, there was a basketball game. And I can remember coming and sitting right over there and watching the games, and pretty much have been doing that, you know, ever since. It's like anything. When you lose something that's been a part of you, you know, there's emotions and feelings that go along with that. But this, you know, this thing has served us well, and this gym put her time in, and you know, we have outgrown it, and so it would be nice if we could keep this as a practice gym. But you know, just the way things work, I mean, we've just outgrown this facility and the spaces needed, you know, for classrooms, and I'm gonna be sad to see it go, but we've got a great new facility that we're gonna be able to move into. This thing has a lot of history. Some of the best players in the state, some of the best teams in the state, some of the best games ever played in the state have been played right here in this gym. And so, you know, it's an institution. And you know, although the building itself may be gone, the memories are going to live on. You know, in 1987, we hosted the state tournament, and you know, we played three games here, but two of them were just classics. I mean, they were against quality teams, and we had to come from behind to win. And the gym was full, and it was loud. This gym is the loudest gym I've ever been in. When it's full, I mean, the sound, I mean, you can almost feel the sound on your shoulders. And it was certainly like that in 87. You know, we hit a half court shot one time in the mid 90s to beat an undefeated Northside team. You know, we won, you know, numerous championships, you know, in this gym. Ron Lonnie Brewer, who played for us. Nick Bradford played for us and went on and played at the University of Kansas and has played overseas for 10 or 12 years. I almost hesitate to start naming names because I'm going to forget someone. But, you know, not only people who played for us, but, you know, opponents, the best players in the state. You know, we tried to match up with those teams and those players. It's been a blessing for us, and I think for the people in the city that enjoy high school basketball, this venue, when it's full, there's nothing like it. There's nothing like it.
February 26th marked the 100th anniversary of the largest student strike in the University of Arkansas Fayetteville campus history. The protest, referred to as the X-ray incident, took place after 36 prominent students were expelled for publishing an underground newspaper critical of the U of A. As Ozarks at Largest Jacqueline Froelich reports, the strike was widely supported, reflecting an emerging progressive political ideology of the time.
Charlie Allison is managing editor for University Relations at the University of Arkansas, the perfect person to interview for this story, as it turns out. Not only is he a university insider, he's written one of two published accounts about the so-called X-ray incident. He first came across it researching UA newspaper history for a master's thesis some years back.
The X-ray was published as an underground sort of publication and newspaper that was protesting a variety of things, among them policies at the university, the general lack of quality among the professors, as the students saw it. But they were also protesting the high prices of textbooks in downtown Fayetteville and the lousy condition of the streets. They were all dirt at that time. So the students were just letting out a lot of steam.
Allison says the sanctioned school paper at the time, the University Weekly, was not covering growing disillusionment on campus. The rogue students referred to themselves as the Iconoclasts and likely named their four-page tabloid the X-ray at the time because cathode ray radiography, newly invented, was all the rage. Most of the Iconoclasts were privileged upperclassmen, including the sons of an associate state Supreme Court justice, a former state attorney general, and a state tax commissioner. So on a wintry Saturday morning 100 years ago, they distributed their screed all over campus and were promptly kicked out of school.
The student population at the university at that time was about 700, a little bit more than that. And when these 36 students got expelled, the rest of the student body, instead of saying, oh, too bad, they decided to protest themselves, and they went on strike.
The Iconoclasts were mirroring a current of political reform led by the Progressive Party, newly formed that year. The agenda was to eliminate corrupt government and business oligarchs, outlaw the lynchings of blacks, regulate child labor, shutter sweatshops, restrict immigration, preserve the environment, and create a safe food supply. Progressives also sought to beef up the franchise via direct primaries and women's suffrage. And the progressive movement's most ardent proselytes, middle-class college students, fueled by popular muckraking journalism, both national and local. The entire student body struck for a full week. They were, among other things, upset that their instructors did not engage in lively and critical dialectic.
And part of it was because they had a professor named Charles Brough, who was exceedingly good. He was very good at engaging the students and teaching them economics. And so tons of students were signing up for his economics classes. They would never have signed up for an economics class otherwise, but he was just such a good professor. And when they compared what he was doing with what the other professors were doing, the other professors were competent in their knowledge of the subject, but they weren't inspiring the students. They weren't engaging them in ways that the students wanted.
Charles Hillman Brough, who was a declared progressive, would become governor of Arkansas just 4 years later. He and two other professors were the only faculty who supported the student strike, which was picked up by mainstream media.
the media coverage was good across the state and in the local media. Part of it was the students themselves. They were writing letters home, telling their parents what was going on, explaining we're on strike. We're not creating a ruckus or anything, but we are politely stating our terms, and we're staying away from class until things are resolved. We may get booted out ourselves, but we feel like we have a principal at stake, and we're willing to stay. And so they were sending letters to back home in Paragould, back home in Little Rock, all over the state. And it didn't help the university administration that the 36 who were expelled were 36 students from relatively prominent families. A couple of them were sons of Board of Trustees members. Now, that's not good.
An old sepia-colored postcard titled "The X-Ray Demonstration" shows several hundred well-dressed male students gathered on Dixon, bundled up against the winter chill wearing woolen overcoats, felt Homburgs, and straw hats. University of Arkansas Board of Trustees were called in to quell the situation, including the chair, then Arkansas Governor George Donaghy.
And they come up to Fayetteville by train and get off at the depot, and he realizes, oh, well, this is not not a boy's prank. This is a real strike. These students really mean what they say. And they hold a meeting up at the campus. And basically, the 36 students had been expelled based on a rule that had been adopted in 1905. And it was a rule that prevented unauthorized publications from being distributed on campus. The Donaghy and the board basically crafted a position that helped save face for the faculty who had expelled the students, but also reinstated the students. Basically, they said the faculty was right to have expelled these students based on the 1905 law, but the 1905 law policy itself was not justified. We're going to get rid of the policy. We're going to reinstate the students, and everything will be hunky-dory.
While most contemporary protest movements are met with disdain, the X-ray demonstrators were embraced.
I think they got away with it because, first of all, they were united in their effort. But they also received a lot of support from around the state and from the local Fayetteville community. Even though they complained about the high prices at the various stores and about the condition of the roads, the local community went out of its way to support them.
Nothing like it has happened since, says Charlie Allison.
The X-ray incident is a one of a kind in the university's history. Without doubt, there have been other times when there was dissent on campus. During the 1960s, there were protests against the war, and so there were a lot of dissent during that period. But nothing on the scale of the whole university body walking out and refusing to go to classes.
Which would be a nightmare for UA Public Relations Managing Editor Charlie Allison to spin if a demonstration the scope of the 1912 protest took place on the U of A campus today. 17,000 students would go on strike.
It's not real well known. It happened in 1912. We didn't have Twitter and Facebook at the time. And so it made a big splash at the time. The students, though, went right back to classwork. They even asked for professors to give them extra work to make up for the week that they had been out on strike. So it was there, and then it was over, you know, as far as most of the campus was concerned. Life went back to normal, and the event itself sort of faded into memory.
But not for Chris Branham, a reporter for the Arkansas Democrat Gazette. After reading Allison's account of the protest, he wrote a research paper about the X-ray incident as a UA journalism grad student 3 years ago.
I think it was quite a spectacle. I mean, and fortunately there were photographs that documented what happened.
Branham dug into the iconoclasts' grievances and found they were upset about faculty favoritism, lousy library facilities, excessive money spent on sport rather than academics, and widespread corruption, a notion, Branham says, several of the students likely picked up from politicized parents.
They were looking for a way to sort of unleash what they would talk about on campus and in the debate club, which several students belong to. Several students belong to these thinking societies that had developed on campus, literary societies. These were well-read students, and they knew what was going on, and it seemed like they wanted to really kind of create their own little mini revolution here on campus.
A few years later, some students attempted to resurrect the X-ray. They were promptly expelled. And as for the iconoclasts, they went on to graduate with some leading successful public lives in politics and law.
William Roy Penix, and this is an important name. He was one of the iconoclasts. He was expelled. He became a lawyer. He was elected to the State House in 1927. He later became the mayor of Jonesboro, and he has successful law practice in there. His son, Bill, in 1955, was the civil rights attorney for his father's firm who worked to integrate the school district in Hoxie.
And what's most remarkable is that the sanctioned student newspaper at the time, the University Weekly, in the end, too, supported the iconoclasts. Here's what the editor, Lilburn Hayes Merriweather, wrote.
Since I believe that the paper told the truth, and this old university is full of graft and crookedness as it can be, I agreed to stand by the student body and hold out for the 36th to be reinstated. And then he goes on to write, if it's a case of the hit dog yelping, that faculty sure was hit because they yelped if I ever heard a yelp.
But Chris Branham agrees that such widespread dissent will likely never happen again on the University of Arkansas campus. Maybe.
Maybe if they took away students' phone privileges. Maybe that might lead it. That might happen, but anyway.
Artifacts regarding the X-ray incident can be found in special collections in Mullins Library on the University of Arkansas campus. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Jacqueline Froelich.
Late last week, the university newspaper, the Arkansas Traveler, published a 1,400-word account of the X-ray incident, distilled from Chris Branham's research paper.
Earth, sky.
Monday, February 27th. If you're in the Northern Hemisphere, you can see all five visible planets sometime between sundown and late evening, tonight, and for the next several weeks.
South of the equator, you can see four planets. The exception is the most elusive planet, Mercury. In their outward order from the Sun, the visible planets are Mercury, Venus, Mars, Jupiter, and Saturn.
Start looking for the planets as soon as darkness falls. Look westward first, the direction of sunset. Tonight you'll find the waxing crescent moon above the brilliant planets Jupiter and Venus. When it's dark enough, draw a line downward through the moon, Jupiter, and Venus to locate Mercury near the sunset point on the western horizon.
Now turn to the opposite side of the sky, the east, at nightfall. Mars lurks low in the east when the sun goes down. It's about at its best now for this two-year period, very bright and reddish. You might be able to pick it out just by looking for the brightest, reddest object in the east at nightfall.
The fifth planet, Saturn, is up in the east by about midnight, as seen from around the globe. Saturn shines close to a bright star now, Spica in the constellation Virgo. Saturn looks golden, while Spica sparkles blue-white.
We have sky charts at the Tonight page of earthsky.org. Earth Sky is a clear voice for science.
We're at earthsky.org.
This is Ozarks at Large. The Arkansas Department of Workforce Services has received a grant to train more than 1,500 Arkansans to become nurses. Roby Brock from our content partner TalkBusiness.net has the details.
I'm Roby Brock with your Talk Business update, a recap of the biggest business and political stories of the last week. Wellspun Pipe, which located in Little Rock's Port Authority in 2009, announced its second facility expansion this past week, adding 200 new jobs and $100 million in new investment. Could be the foundation for even more. Wellspun currently employs 530 workers at its pipe construction facility in Little Rock. It's invested $280 million prior to the new commitment. In total, Wellspun's annual payroll is expected to top $40 million. The expansion will add a new pipeline product for the oil and gas industry. Rashish Shikhani, a vice president for Wellspun, contends that a major steel mill, a potential billion-dollar investment, could eye Central Arkansas for a location with this latest expansion. Walmart, the Bentonville-based retail giant, posted fourth-quarter earnings of almost $5.2 billion compared to a little over $5 billion 1 year ago. Revenue for the world's largest retailer topped $123 billion during the quarter. That was an improvement over $116.3 billion in the previous year. For the full year, Walmart's revenue exceeded $446 billion, up about 6%, with profits rising 2.7% to a little over $15.5 billion. Same-store sales in the U.S. also increased for the second consecutive quarter. Arkansas export growth has been on the rise for more than a decade. New statistics show that in 2011, the state's exports grew at a healthy 7% clip. According to new data released by the International Trade Administration, Arkansas exports rose to $5.6 billion in 2011, up from $5.2 billion in 2010. Merchandise export sales increased to several countries, including Australia, France, Singapore, Korea, and Mexico. The Arkansas Department of Workforce Services has received a $4.9 million grant from the U.S. Department of Labor to train more than 1,500 Arkansans to become nurses. The project will target qualified individuals who are on waiting lists to enter nursing programs, unemployed and dislocated workers, low-income Arkansans, and those currently working in the healthcare field looking to further their credentials. Workforce officials say that the number of registered nurses will increase by 27% over the next 5 years. Industry officials say that nearly 1,500 qualified nursing school applicants are denied enrollment annually due to limited capacity. From the Capitol, plenty of politics. There were budget developments from the legislative session this week. After several days of debate, Governor Beebe and Republican lawmakers agreed to disagree. While GOP legislators pushed for nearly $21 million in budget cuts, the governor countered their counterproposal with a modest $678,000 final offer. Filing season also began on Thursday, with all 135 House and Senate seats up for grabs. What kind of election year does it promise to be? Well, there's a good chance we may see a record number of candidates file for state office. I'm Roby Brock, and that is your Talk Business Update.
It's Monday, February 27th, 2012. I'm Antoinette Grajeda, and joining me now is Becca Bacon-Martin, Features Editor at Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
I just said to Antoinette, we're going to talk about dolls, and she made a face at me. But these are cool dolls.
Okay.
You know, the University Museum has vast expanses of collections. I tell people to think about the warehouse in Raiders of the Lost Ark. Okay. 7 million items.
Really?
Arrowheads, pot shards, taxidermied animals, Mexican masks, and these 26 folk art dolls that were made by a school teacher in Chicago in the 1960s. There's only, to the best of what I can figure out, they say there are 10 sets of these dolls. She handmade all of them as teaching dolls about Black history.
Okay.
And they're on show through Wednesday at the Global Campus on the Square.
All right.
Fascinating. Fascinating. Now, the way they came to the University Museum is that there were folks in Eureka Springs named Hilda and Milton Guther, and they had a doll museum in the 1980s. Apparently, they moved to Florida, which is rumor, not fact.
Okay.
But in 1986, they donated these dolls to the University Museum, and in 1987, they donated a collection of Kachinas.
Huh.
And then they went away.
The dolls or the people?
The people.
Okay.
And so now we have this great collection of dolls that the Philadelphia Doll Museum is all excited about. And here they are out where you can see them. They're only on show through Wednesday. This is the end of a Black History Month event. Berta Bell's Handmade Dolls. The woman's name was Ida Roberta Bell. And hours at the Global Campus Center on the Square are 8 to 4:30 today, tomorrow, and Wednesday. This is free, and it's cool.
All right. Well, I may have to wander over there then.
See, I was right.
Thanks, Becca. Becca Bacon-Martin is Features Editor at Northwest Arkansas Newspapers. KUAF is supported by Fayetteville Window Washing, offering both residential and commercial cleaning services, as well as power washing, gutter protection, and more. Information is available on the web at FayettevilleWindowWashing.com.
From Little Rock, I'm Stephen Cook with Arkansas Songs.
Thank you.
Joshua Altheimer was born 1910 in Altheimer in East Jefferson County. Although little is known about him, and he recorded only briefly and never as a solo artist, Altheimer made a strong impact on blues piano playing. Josh Altheimer cut more than 50 songs with Big Bill Brunsey, who has his own Arkansas connections to nearby Lake Dick. Brunsey later became a legendary international music ambassador and among the contenders for King of the Delta Blues. Big Bill called Josh Altheimer the best blues piano player I ever heard. The known recorded canon of Joshua Altheimer is as a sideman from 1938 to 1940 for Big Bill Brunsey, who went by simply Big Bill at the time. Even during this short period, Josh Altheimer's piano proficiency is proven over the course of a variety of blues styles and tempos with Big Bill.
Come on, baby, now it's all right. Shake your leg, gal, and shake it all night. Come on, baby, and shake your leg. Come on, baby, shake a leg. Come on, gal, and shake a leg. In this old ballroom tonight.
Big Bill even name-checks his friend and favorite piano player Josh Altheimer in their June 1940 song recorded in Chicago, Midnight Steppers, singing, Big Bill and Josh are here to play the blues for you. But however symbiotic the musical relationship between the two Arkansasers from Jefferson County, it wasn't to last. While based in Chicago with the Brunsey combo, Josh Altheimer contracted pneumonia. He died in November 1940. Altheimer was only 30 years old. Brunsey quickly picked up another young, up-and-coming pianist for his band named Memphis Slim.
I'm just a lone wolf, baby, strolling through this world alone. Now I'm just a lone wolf, baby, strolling through this world alone. Loud whiskey pretty women have caused me to lose my home.
The town Altheimer was named for plantation owners in the area, Jewish German immigrants named Altheimer, who encouraged the Cotton Belt Railroad to run through the area in the 1880s. Bill Brunsey said Josh Altheimer was of black, white, and Jewish heritage. There's only one known photograph of Josh Altheimer, and that's with Big Bill and the rest of the band, not long before Altheimer's untimely death. This song, Lone Wolf Blues, the opener and the next song, feature Brunsey, Altheimer, and Walnut Ridge native Washboard Sam, who is said to be Big Bill's half-brother.
Wondering why do men have the blues? Why'd you get you another woman if the one you got ain't true? So you can keep on a smiling. Yeah, just keep on a smiling. Now you can keep on a smiling just to drive your blues away.
In sharp contrast to his partner Josh Altheimer, Big Bill Brunsey would go on for many more years and to much acclaim. In fact, Brunsey's name would become one of the best known in blues music. Beyond Altheimer and Memphis Slim, Brunsey would partner with other pianists of note, Black Bob, Georgia Tom Dorsey, and Phillips County native Roosevelt Sykes among them. But of Josh Altheimer of Altheimer, his all-too-brief piano collaborator, Brunsey simply said, "He seemed just right for me." Here in its entirety is pianist Josh Altheimer of Altheimer and Big Bill Brunsey, both of Jefferson County, with Washboard Sam of Walnut Ridge in Lawrence County, performing Midnight Steppers, recorded in Chicago in June 1940, just months before Joshua Altheimer's death.
Baby, now it's all right. Shake your leg, gal, and shake it all night. Come on, baby, and shake a leg. Come on, baby, shake a leg. Come on, gal, and shake a leg. In this old ballroom tonight. Come on, baby, now, and take a chance. If you're 9 or 90, gal, you can do this dance. Come on, baby, and shake a leg. Come on, gal, and shake a leg. Come on, baby, shake a leg. In this old doll room tonight. this gal come in the door. Everybody here's got one foot on the floor. Come on, baby, and shake a leg. Come on, baby, and shake a leg. Come on, gal, and shake a leg in this old ballroom tonight. After 12 o'clock, we're gonna close the door. Let nobody in, gal, and can't nobody go. Come on, baby, and shake a leg. Come on, baby, shake a leg. Come on, gal, and shake a leg in this old ballroom tonight. Hey, Mr. Josh. Got eats and drinks and dancing room too. Big Bill and Josh are here to play the blues for you. Come on, baby, and shake a leg. Come on, gal, and shake a leg. Come on, baby, and shake a leg in this old ballroom tonight.
From June 1940, blues pianist Josh Altimer of Altimer backing Big Bill Brunzi of Lake Dick, both of Jefferson County, with Midnight Steppers. From June 1940. It's another song of Arkansas. From Little Rock, I'm Stephen Cook with Arkansongs.
Arkansongs is a production of FM 89 and Experiment Station Studios. Associate producer of Arkansongs is Keith Merks. For more information, visit arkansongs.org. Arkansongs, since 1999.
This is Ozarks at Large. Al Bell's fingertips are firmly planted on the history of American soul, R&B, popular, gospel, and rock music. He was with Memphis-based Stax Records during the label's glory days, first as the head of promotions, later as chairman. There, he was instrumental in the success of such artists as Otis Redding, the Staple Singers, and Isaac Hayes. He also served as president of Motown Records and has been a DJ, producer, and entrepreneur. Last week, he spoke on the University of Arkansas campus as a guest of the African and African American Studies program of the J. William Fulbright College of Arts and Sciences and the Office of Diversity Programs of the Sam M. Walton College of Business. While here, he talked with Ozarks at Large's Kyle Kellums.
Before Stax Records, when he was a very young man in Arkansas, Al Bell fell in love with music. As student council president at his high school, he was put in charge of school dances. He'd glean from fellow students, especially the girls, what songs clicked and why. He'd use that same approach when he was a DJ in Little Rock, then Memphis, then Washington, D.C. I asked him if he was able to select his own music to play on the radio during his years as a DJ.
Yes, I did. Underscore and all cap. I did, and I thought it was natural and normal. And it allowed me, frankly, to become the kind of successful disc jockey I was at that time.
Al Bell quit radio when disc jockeys began to have much less say in what records they were able to spin. But he took his knowledge of the business with him to Stax, where he was put in charge of promotion. I imagine that experience being on that end of the business helped you much when you were hired by Stax to be the director of promotions.
No question.
You understood.
I understood the music. And I understood what different jocks, disc jockeys around the country liked. I knew what a Georgia Woods in Philadelphia at that time, the kind of music that he liked. I knew what a Rodney Jones in Chicago liked and so forth and so on. So I knew of our releases, when I listened to some music, I knew what disc jockey to take it to that would start it for me because I knew that's what he liked.
So if you had a release from, I don't know, Rufus Thomas.
Right.
And you'd say, okay, I bet I can break this easier in Philadelphia because of that jock up there.
I knew that I could take that to Shelley, the Playboy Stewart at WYLD in New Orleans, Louisiana, and that Rufus Thomas would get burned up. He would go crazy over Rufus Thomas, and I'd tell everybody else in the country what he was doing and spread my Rufus Thomas as a result of that.
Now, when you say you took it, did you physically take it? Would you go to the radio stations?
Oh, yes. I'd go to the radio stations, spend time with the disc jockeys. And not only would I go to the stations, I became more or less like the living publication that had the information on the industry. Those black disc jockeys at that time did not have a publication that provided information on what was going on in their segment of the industry. Well, I was involved with everybody, so as I would go from station to station, I could tell them what was going on in different markets, tell them the promotional activities that a disc jockey was doing in a certain market, would tell them records that the disc jockeys were playing in other markets, and why the disc jockeys had told me they were playing those records, because I'm a disc jockey. I love music and playing music for people. So I would share with them all of that information so they would know what to do. And when I went to Stax, they had great music in the can that they hadn't released that they didn't think was great because they really didn't know. And my job was to turn the company around at that time because it was 90,000 in the hole and about to go under. Well, I was able to go to the music that they had been recorded already and was in the can and started listening to that music, and knowing what I knew about the listeners and the audience out there, I started selecting the releases and releasing that product and then telling the producers what they should be producing based on what I knew as it related to people.
What were a couple of those records that were in the can but hadn't been released yet?
This one wasn't in the can. This one was being produced, called You Don't Know Like I Know by Sam and Dave. As a matter of fact, that was on Christmas Day. That was the first recording that I broke at Stax. It was being recorded at that time, and Jim Stewart was asking me in conversation, what do you think about it? You heard them working it up. I said, it's a hit record. I said, it's a hit record. It's a hit record and a hit song because, one, of the rhythm feel, and, two, what the lyrics meant to African Americans. Because it was, you don't know like I know what the Lord has done for me. So I knew how that would resonate, you know, in the marketplace. And I talked about that with Jim Stewart, and it influenced him so much until he said, well, I need to put, based on what you're saying, I need to put extra emphasis on the backbeat. Well, I didn't quite know what he was talking about at that time. And what he did was he went and put a tambourine on top of the snare drum and had the drummer to take the back end of the drumstick and hit that snare, which would then reverberate through the snare. Hit the tambourine, which would reverberate through the snare, and that's how you have the sound that you have on Sam and Dave, You Don't Know Like I Know, which was their first hit record.
You don't know like I know.
And what I did was, at that time, I knew what happened at radio stations and all of that. I broke it on Christmas Day, because on Christmas Day, I knew that the part-time jocks were on at the station, and they were playing all of the Christmas music. So I got the records to these part-time disc jockeys during the week and told them, I'm giving you something that nobody else has, and you can play this on Christmas Day, and it's going to get you a lot of attention because nobody has it but you, and you instead of playing all of the Christmas music, play this. And they would play Jingle Bells, Silent Night, etc. You Don't Know Like I Know Sam and Dave. Another Christmas song, another Christmas song. You Don't Know Like I Know Sam and Dave. And December 26th, it was a broken record. The demand was in the marketplace.
Was that a great feeling when you'd break a record? I mean, when you started to see it go up the charge?
My God, that I don't even know how to explain that feeling. I don't know if great is the strong enough of a word. It is so satisfying, and then knowing what it does for the artist, I mean, just adds to it, because what drives me is wanting to get great music to build the artist's career. And then to see a piece of product happen like that in the marketplace and people start reacting is great. And I love seeing people react positively to music. So when something breaks in the marketplace and the demand is there, that's my satisfaction. That's my reward. That's what I want. That satisfies me.
At Stax in the 60s and 70s, when that roster includes Otis Redding, Sam and Dave, Rufus Thomas, Isaac Hayes, all these folks, one of the maybe the second largest African-American owned business in the United States at the time.
Yes.
Those had to be heady days for those of you at Stax. You're on top of the world.
Well, you know, it's interesting. We never saw it like that. And only in retrospect do I have some appreciation for having the second largest African-American owned business in America. We were really busy about the business of doing what we were doing. Our goal was to make great music, to market that product in the marketplace, to work with our artists and get our artists where they were accepted by the general market and make sure they had great concerts, and that we continued to do that, that we were building the careers of the writers, building the careers of the producers. And that's what we talked about on a daily basis. We lived that. So we really weren't into, if you will, those other things. We paid attention to, from time to time, the charts to see what a record had done on the charts. But that really wasn't it. What we talked about was sales. You know, how many records did we sell? And it wasn't to count the money as much as that's letting us know how much it's appreciated. And that's what the conversations were about. I mean, when Black Enterprise magazine called me, I wouldn't give them any information. I said, I'm not interested in where we are, you know, who's the largest African-American-owned business in America. I'm not interested in that. Don't even include us in it. But somehow or another, they got whatever information they got, you know, and made the conclusion. The interesting thing is about 3 or 4 years ago, Barry Gordy and I were in Philadelphia. He was number one. And Barry said, you know, man, I got to tell you, they said I was the number one largest black-owned business in America based on revenue generated. He said, but I just figured this out. He said, I used to think you were crazy releasing all of those albums. And I was releasing these singles and up and down the charts. And said, why are they all releasing all these albums down there? He said, and I didn't realize until later on that you could turn around and sell 100,000 albums and generate more money on 100,000 albums than I was generating on my number one single. He said, so he said, so you were generating more money than me. I said, you think so, Barry? He said, no, I know so.
Radio, it used to be, if you were in New Orleans,
right?
Radio sounded like New Orleans radio.
Yes,
you
sir.
Went to D.C., you knew where you were in D.C., Tulsa, Seattle, wherever.
Yes.
It sounded different. There were regional hits.
Yes.
There was personality.
Yes.
It's not like that anymore.
No.
And that's a shame.
It's horrible. Borderline criminal. But you see, what it did, you had then, as we changed things to the extent, as opposed to you not having under laws to have ownership of any more than two radio stations in the market, mm-hmm. Well, an AM and an FM ultimately. And I think this started under President Reagan, and it was accelerated under President Clinton, where it was possible to go in and, as a matter of fact, own every darn thing in the marketplace. And it,
from 2,000 miles away.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And but if you own, you know, 200-300 stations across the country, if you're going to control it from a management standpoint, then you can't afford to play in New Orleans what people want to hear in New Orleans and in Chicago what people want to hear in Chicago. You have to have music that's being played in New Orleans, Chicago, and all over the place. And later for those people in the market, let's just play what's popular and what's on the charts, and we can control and manage that. And it takes too much time, and we have other exposure and risk by allowing people to select music in those markets. We just have to control it better than that. So it went out of the window. And as a result of that, you don't have these unique artists getting a breath of air and a break in exposure in these individual markets where they get attention on a regional level and it's picked up, or you have an opportunity to explore it nationally.
And you don't get the unique voices that are bringing you the
no.
DJs. I'm sure when you were a jock, you didn't sound like anybody else.
No. No, I didn't. No, I didn't. I know I didn't. Made sure. Miss Bell, baby boy.
And there's albellpresents.com, right?
Yes. That's, I must tell you, the motivation for that is to take and put a radio station online. Presently, it's just me, where we are playing this different music. And the first channel, ultimately there'll be 10, but the first channel is Al Bell Presents American Soul Music. And then we'll have rock and jazz, et cetera, with other people doing that. And we're starting a parallel piece to that that's a companion. That's Al Bell Presents American Soul Music. That's a 3-hour syndicated radio show that's done on terrestrial stations presently we're on Memphis, Tennessee from 7 to 10 on Friday night. And the idea there is to influence those terrestrial radio stations because I'm letting my personality show and I'm playing music that they're not playing and the audience is responding and reacting. So hopefully they'll respond and react enough to cause management at the stations to say, wait a minute. We got to consider this kind of music that Al Bell is playing. We're making money with him. And maybe we should consider personality once again. And they'll find that it's to their benefit. But at the same time, I'll use it to promote the radio station online. And as a result of that, continue to expose more people to the music and influence more people because I want to see our business get back to dealing with the artistry.
Al Bell, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
Al Bell, former chair of Stax Records and former president of Motown Records, talked to Ozarks at Large's Kyle Kellums last week while he was on the University of Arkansas campus. He was at the U of A as a guest of the African and African American Studies program of the J. William Fulbright College of Arts and Sciences and the Office of Diversity Programs of the Sam M. Walton College of Business. There's more, much more, from their conversation online at ozarksatlarge.com. And this is Ozarks at Large, and time now for a trivia question. Today's winner will receive a pair of movie tickets to any local Malco movie theater, and also a pair of tickets to Sona's upcoming concert next weekend, March 10th at Walton Arts Center. The Symphony of Northwest Arkansas will be performing with the Fayetteville Jazz Collective. Now, earlier in the show, I mentioned that it is International Polar Bear Day. So in honor of that, today's trivia question has to do with polar bears. And it's fairly simple. When you think of polar bears, you think of their very white fur. So my question is, what color is their skin? If you have a guess or you know the answer, give us a call at 800-522-5823. That's 800-522-KUAF. Again, the trivia question, polar bears have white fur, and I want to know, what color is their skin? Good luck.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Monday. It's the 27th of February, 2012. It's the birthday of Henry Wadsworth Longfellow, Portland, Maine, 1807, went off to Bowdoin College with Nathaniel Hawthorne. After the death of his wife, Mary Potter, from complications of a miscarriage, Longfellow found solace in reading German poetry and began writing poetry of his own. His first collection, Ballads and Other Poems, came out in 1841. It included The Wreck of the Hesperus and The Village Blacksmith, was very popular. 6 years later, Evangeline, then The Song of Hiawatha, then The Courtship of Miles Standish. And after the tragic death of his second wife, Fanny, in a fire, he translated Dante's Inferno. It was on this date, 1860, Abraham Lincoln gave a speech against slavery at Cooper Union in New York City. The Great Hall filled 1,500 New Yorkers curious to see this man from Illinois. One eyewitness said, when he rose to speak, I was greatly disappointed. He was tall and so angular and awkward that I had for an instant a feeling of pity for so ungainly a man. But once Lincoln started to speak, quote, his face lighted up, the whole man was transfigured. I forgot his clothes, his personal appearance, his individual peculiarities. Forgetting myself, I was on my feet like the rest, yelling like a wild Indian, cheering this wonderful man. The speech was reprinted widely. The New York Times printed it in its entirety on the front page the next day. It made Lincoln famous. He was invited to speak all over the country, and that summer the Republican Party named him their candidate for the 1860 presidential election, a speech that ended with the words, "Let us have faith that right makes might, and in that faith let us to the end dare to do our duty as we understand it." And it's the birthday of John Steinbeck, Salinas, California, 1902. Supported himself as a manual laborer, wrote about migrant workers. His first success was the novel Tortilla Flat in 1935, became a movie starring Spencer Tracy and Hedy Lamarr. Drove around California in an old bakery truck, looking at migrant workers writing about them for a newspaper. And in less than 6 months, out of his own journal, he had a 200,000-word manuscript, Grapes of Wrath. John Steinbecker said, "We are lonesome animals. We spend all our life trying to be less lonesome." Here's a poem for today by Stephen Dobbins entitled Pursuit. Each thing I do, I rush through so I can do something else. In such a way do the days pass, a blend of stock car racing and the never-ending building of a Gothic cathedral. Through the windows of my speeding car, I see all that I love falling away, books unread, jokes untold, landscapes unvisited. And why? What treasure do I expect in my future? Rather, it is the confusion of childhood loping behind me, the chaos in the mind, the failure chipping away at each success. Glancing over my shoulder, I see its shape, and so move forward as someone in the woods at night might hear the sound of approaching feet and stop to listen. Then, instead of silence, he hears some creature trying to be silent. What else can he do but run, rushing blindly down the path, stumbling, struck in the face by sticks, the other ever closer, yet not really hurrying or out of breath, teasing its kill. Pursuit, poem by Stephen Dobbins from Cemetery Nights, published by Penguin Books, used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac, sponsored by Constant Contact, celebrating the launch of Social Campaigns, a brand new social media marketing tool. Learn more at constantcontact.com. And by IBM, working to help mid-sized businesses become the engines of a smarter planet. Learn more at ibm.com/engines. Produced by Kathy Roach, written by Holly Vanderhaar. Be well, do good work, keep in touch.
All right, time now for the answer to our trivia question. Before Writer's Almanac, I asked, in honor of International Polar Bear Day, polar bears have white fur, but what color is their skin? And the answer is black. According to the National Wildlife Federation, in contrast to the white fur, the skin is black, and the black skin more readily absorbs sunlight, which helps to keep the bear warm. Also, the polar bear's tongue is also black. We will put all of the correct names into the ceramic cow and draw a winner, and our winner will receive a pair of movie tickets to any local Malco movie theater and also a pair of tickets to Sona's upcoming concert next Saturday at Walton Art Center, and those tickets will be available at Will Call. We will give you a call to let you know if you've won in just a minute. Support for KUAF comes from the Kumon Center, with an after-school math and reading enrichment program for pre-K through high school students. An open house will be held on Saturday, March 3rd at the Lowell and Fayetteville locations. Games, refreshments, and a raffle will be offered. Information regarding the Lowell event is available at 770-0055 or Facebook/Kumon of Lowell. Also, the University of Arkansas Theater presents Anonymous, now through Sunday, March 4th, at the University Theater Fine Arts Center in Fayetteville. This production follows an immigrant's journey as he compromises his identity to survive in America. Tickets and more information are available at 575-3946. This is KUAF 91.3 FM, Fayetteville, Rogers, Fort Smith, Bear Creek Springs. Ozarks at Large is a production of KUAF. I'm Antoinette Grajeda. Have a pleasant Monday.